is Adrian.
And this is Ethan.
And this is Whiskey and Wires, brought to you by Intuitive Networks, where we talk all things whiskey.
And all things tech.
Hey, whiskey and tech heads, welcome to episode 2.
Glad to be back. Glad to have another bottle of whiskey in front of us. What do you got for us today?
We had so much fun the last episode. We're like, well, why don't we just keep this going? This has been a blast. The whiskey. Oh, wow. This is a heavy hitter. What does the bottle say over there, Ethan?
Let's see. It's a full proof 1792. Oh, dang. That says 125 proof.
125 proof. So for those of you that maybe aren't in the States, ABV is just divide by half. So this it should say that on there.
Yeah, that's 60.
Math is hard.
Yeah, math is very hard. Luckily, it says on there 62.5% alcohol volume. I thought last time we were talking about whiskeys, we had a 94%?
94 proof.
94 proof, pardon me. And you said that was, you know, a little bit up there.
It's a good standard. It's a good standard proof.
Okay.
This one is, for lack of a better term, you know, this is a big whiskey. You know, it's definitely going to put some hair on your chest if you're not careful.
Well, we have Uber. why don't you tell me a little bit about this?
I'm going to ask you a question, a little trivia here. For those who don't know, I'm a huge trivia person. I used to be on a team called Quiz in My Pants over in the Sacramento area. We go to some breweries, and we do pretty well every now and again. Usually wind up in fourth place, but you know, that's
that doesn't sound like you're very good at this.
You know, we're just good enough.
Okay,
not enough to place. But we're always just barely, barely enough.
Probably better than me.
But 1792. The question is that what does that stand for? If you were to guess, why is it called 1792?
My best guess would be that's the year that the distillery started. Maybe that this particular brewer was founded.
That is a fantastic guess.
But wrong.
But it's false.
Okay.
No, it's wrong. No, 1792 is when the great state of Kentucky became a state.
Okay. And I know that's significant because, you know, bourbon's from Kentucky. Is that the whole story behind this? It's just Kentucky's own?
Well, actually, the distillery itself is called Barton.
Okay.
So they make very old Barton, even though you can't really get in the States. It's mainly Midwest and some of the South where they have very old Barton. Really good value whiskey. But then they have, it used to be, they actually rebranded this, but a while back it used to be Barton's 1792 Reserve.
Okay, because
now they kind of just call it 1792.
Yeah, I was looking for it, and I see now in the back it does say Barton's. So, yeah, that's interesting.
So, Barton's is in Bardstown, Kentucky.
Okay.
Heaven Hill is in Bardstown, Kentucky, the last whiskey distillery we had.
Are those the only two that are there?
There's two major ones, Barton and Heaven Hill, but now it's kind of just exploding and there's a bunch of craft distilleries. But
sure,
the oldest
sure.
craft one, ever heard of Willett?
I don't think that I have.
They have like this cool pot still bottle.
Oh, I think I've seen those.
We're definitely
going to
be doing an episode.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
That. But,
sure.
Really interesting. They have kind of like the classic pot still kind of, to make their whiskey. It's kind of front and center when you go on a tour over there.
Sure.
But Bardstown is very historical. It's kind of like considered like the bourbon mecca.
Okay.
It's a very small town, kind of has that Main Street kind of vibe. But, you know, Heaven Hill's there, Barton's there.
You mentioned last time with Elijah Craig, I think it was, that he was the first to kind of char the inside of the barrels. Is that kind of thought of as the birthplace of that style of bourbon? Or is it more just that area is famous for it?
I would say it's mainly the state of Kentucky itself.
Okay.
Although some people in Tennessee would maybe claim that they did it first.
Sure.
But they have a completely different process called Lincoln County. And we'll get into that when we have a Tennessee whiskey. I want to kind of say that because it's a pretty cool differentiation. And you talked banana last episode.
Yeah, yeah.
That sometimes Ed says he gets banana. That, there's a reason why Jack Daniels and like Tennessee whiskey tastes and smells like ripened banana in this process.
Well, I hate to veer you away from that story. I'm sure we'll get into it. But kind of like last time, we've had these glasses sitting in front of us for the last 20 minutes or so, just staring at us. Let's take our sips. Yeah, that's a higher proof, all right. We once again have our sound guy. He has
holy balls.
Yeah, he has the biggest pour of all of us.
Do you feel that Kentucky hug?
Holy Kentucky.
Yeah, hug. Kentucky hug. That's what they call it. Yeah.
That's a Kentucky mouth hug right there.
Yeah, it's that warmth. That's it's that whiskey hug.
Oh, I never want it to let go. Now that's interesting. That's definitely a different flavor. It's very strong, but it has very strong flavor to it.
Well, it's foolproof. Now, I kind of want to talk about this.
Yeah.
Foolproof is not barrel proof.
What's the difference?
It's not. So barrel proof could be any proof, whether it be a mix of barrels or a single barrel. Single barrel, whatever proof that is, that happens to be once you think it's ready.
That's it. Just break the barrel and drink it.
If you have four or five barrels or like Stag, George T. Stag or Stag Jr., some of these super allocated stuff. They're small batches. In the case of George T. Stag, a very small batch, but a barrel proof. So what they do is they take all the different averages, they take all the different barrel proof for the barrels, and then the average amount.
Okay.
And that's kind of what they put on the label.
Okay.
But foolproof is the same as entry proof. Now, entry proof is the maximum amount or typically what most distilleries put their non-aged white dog into the barrel.
What's white dog?
White dog is basically the distillate.
Like okay.
After you're done, it's clear. So they call it white dog. Before it touches the barrel, it's
sure, white dog. Sure. Very strong.
White lightning, moonshine, white dog, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
Hooch. But it's one of those things where it's entry proof. So 125. So that's why this is 125 proof. So I just want to make sure, because sometimes, it's marketing, right? If you think because you're getting full proof, you're getting barrel proof. It's close. It's a high proof, but some of those barrel proofs, man, they can get so, up to 135, 140.
So you're telling me that this punch in the face that we're drinking right now, this delightful punch in the face, is it's been mellowed out?
There has been some water added to it, yeah. Okay. Not a lot. It's still a big whiskey, and might I also say a very tasty whiskey.
It is. That's probably the thing that surprised me most, because, going into something being told that it's over 60% alcohol, you kind of expect the strength. I wasn't expecting so much flavor to come through.
Remember, I think last time we were talking about, like, rye versus bourbon.
Sure.
And I said bourbon, sometimes you get that butterscotch.
Mm.
This is definitely butterscotch.
Yeah, for sure.
It's so good. And I still have the finish is long. I guess they'll taste the whiskey. No.
Well, I know that, we've been tasting together before. You kind of swirl it around your mouth, get tasting it. Are there flavors that as I sip more of this, I should be looking out for?
Whatever you taste and you smell is correct. and that's what most people that really know whiskey, if they're, bullshit aside, that's at the end of the day, what you experience is your experience.
Well, that makes me feel better about it. I went to a wine tasting not too long ago and I felt just so dumb. I wasn't tasting anything they were saying.
wine could definitely be pretty kind of foo-foo like that sometimes. It's kind of uppity. It can be pretty uppity, especially like in Napa. Napa Sonoma. Mm-hmm.
And I know that's you kind of came more from liking wine a lot first and then switching down to this. Was that kind of a pull for you in that it was less snooty almost, so that you could just enjoy it?
In the beginning, yes. I find that whiskey and bourbon is starting to head that direction.
I see, yeah.
It's become very much a highbrow thing.
Sure, sure.
Which is kind of funny because, wine historically has always been wine. It's, there's always been good wine and not good wine. But typically speaking, when you hear someone ordering a nice red and, red wine, there's a personality with that.
Sure.
But like bourbon, I'm still trying to figure this out. How is bourbon? I get scotch. Sure. I get scotch. But like bourbon. Like, you're talking like bluegrass.
Yeah.
Hooch. Now is considered upper class.
It is kind of interesting. I went to a bar the other day with you and Ed, actually, where they had the Whistle Pig and the Whistle Pig Old Fashions and everything like that. Something that I'm actually looking forward to having on this show because it was delicious. But that was the first time that I saw, and I think it was the Boss Hog, the Whistle Pig Boss Hog. It was the first time that I saw someone order it with that look that you get when someone orders, like, when they get their keys from the valet and it's a Ferrari. It's that,
right.
It's that really, you know, I'm better than you because I can afford this whiskey. It was kind of surprising, to be honest.
It's a total flex. It's like, you know, I've seen this poor, like a poor fool. Like, I feel so bad because the restaurants, you know, you're paying all kinds of money for this, but like they had a Pappy.
Right. Oh, sure, sure.
Pappy 10.
Yeah.
It was like $200 for a shot.
Now,
and this guy, you could tell. It was clear he was probably on his first or second date.
Sure.
He was flexing. And I'm like, you know, at the end of the night, albeit a great whiskey, he was probably like, why did I do that?
Yeah. Now, I kind of know about Pappy because, you know, obviously talked with you a lot. And you're for everyone listening, Adrian here is a huge whiskey head. But can you just go over real quick, what makes Pappy special?
This is going to be very controversial. Nothing.
Okay.
Nothing.
That is a controversial take from episode two.
They do carry age statements, which is kind of rare now.
Sure.
It ranges from 10 to 23 years.
Which is pretty long for a bourbon. That's more like...
And they are tasty.
Yeah.
Would I pay retail for them? Yes. Would I pay a dollar over it? No.
Okay.
I'm over that game. Because the markup, the secondary market is ridiculous on those, and I just refuse to pay anything but retail.
Now, bringing it back a little bit to what we're having, because I'm still really enjoying this. After that initial burn, this is tasty. You said that there are not usually age indicators on bottles like this. For a bottle like this, how long do you think that they actually barrel these?
Right, so 1782 does have a 12-year.
Okay.
But it's tough to find. They only release it once a year.
Okay.
And sometimes, like, it's like visitor center only, so you have to be in Bardstown.
So small batches.
Right. But I would say that this is probably around 6 to 9 years in a batch.
Okay.
But, you know, people shouldn't be too pissed off about batches. I don't understand. You know, there's definitely great things about age stated or single barrel. Those are great. Like, Four Roses Single Barrel, one of my favorite whiskeys. My dad loves that whiskey. But there's something to be said about consistency.
Absolutely.
In a batch, your goal is to try to make something as consistent as possible from a flavor profile.
Sure.
And to have access to more barrels to achieve that makes it so much easier on the distiller.
Sure.
Or the master taster. And it ends up being a better product overall. Because the last thing you want to do is say, this is the best bottle I ever had. I paid $150 for it. I'm willing to pay it again.
And never be able to find it as good.
And it's just a piece of shit and you can't touch it.
Yeah. Well, that's something in every industry that more and more, you know, as I've branched out into different industries, that's something that I find is so, it's the mark of a good business, whether it's, you know, coming out with food or other businesses as well. Just having consistency with your service is such a big indicator of a good business.
Right.
It's,
you know, that is definitely true in all aspects of business or even customer service. You know, you want to have a consistent and reliable experience, particularly when things don't go well. You know,
right?
Because really, we're in the business of IT. You know, albeit we love good whiskey and, you know, we're passionate about other things like everyone else is, but we're in the business of IT. And usually, when we do our job well, and this is also our industry needs to do better. We have to sometimes like wave our hands in the air and go, "Hey, I just want to make sure, you know, we still exist. You know, things are working well, but also here's why they're working well. We're doing all this work in the back end." You know, we're not just collecting your money until something breaks. But usually when people reach out to us or they remember us, it's usually because they have a problem.
Exactly. I can't say how many times people reached out to us because something broke. It's actually kind of a fun piece of this trade that we're in, especially as, you know, been managing accounts and everything like that. Just from a marketing standpoint, people don't search for IT-related things just because they're curious or just because they want to improve. Yeah. It's very reactive. People look us up when things break. Yeah,
you type in a Google when it auto, like, most searches, you put IT support, it'll be like lost laptop or like lost phone or server down or like phones don't work or ransomware attack.
The simple, you know, locked account. You know, how do I unlock my account? So it's a very wide range that we find, especially as we reach out to new clients and folks who could benefit and be productive from our service, is that it's very hard to convince someone of the value of good IT until it all goes to shit. And you actually need the good IT right then and right now. Whereas a lot of those issues are often avoided altogether if you have it on the front end.
So I know we wanted to spend more time on ransomware because it's such an important topic.
Absolutely.
And it definitely needs another episode on this. But we talked about what ransomware is.
Sure.
How it can affect construction or businesses, or, you know, how they kind of get into the systems or lock things up.
Mm-hmm.
But how does ransomware work? Like, what I mean, because it's so kind of, you know, ethereal in some aspects.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Is it just code? Like, what? How does it work?
In effect, that's part of one of the things that makes it difficult to pin down, is because just like a lot of other, you know, malicious software, malicious ways of doing business within that world, it changes over time. Ransomware is kind of an umbrella statement that's given to this type of attack that basically encrypts your data and forces you to pay to get it back. Great. That's a big overarching definition. But how that happens is often varied in why people have such a big issue with it. It's not like a specific virus that, hey, this is the virus, this is how you protect against it, this is the things that your antivirus needs to look out for. Great, that's never a problem again. With ransomware, someone sends an email with a little phishing thing, you click on it, it infects your software. Okay, you protect against that. Hey, now here's a new email. You click on it, it creates a backdoor to your network. Okay, you protect against that. Okay, now you click on something else, or someone gets into your computer through whatever way that they want to, and they leave a back door. There's all these different methods of delivery that really make it hard to identify exactly what a ransomware attack will look like for your business, which obviously makes the protection from the symptoms a lot of times more important than just the antivirus itself. It's not only protecting you from what we know, but it's how you recover from it if you unfortunately are struck by it.
Right. Like, I remember there was a lot of talk, you know, and they still do this, but brute force attack.
Yeah. So DDoS and brute force attacks are still, they're an issue, but luckily they're actually fairly easy to defend against if you have the right stuff. Most of the time when you hear about companies that struggle from these, it's because they're not willing to protect themselves for whatever reason. It's either perceived cost or something along those lines. They don't want to get what they need to protect themselves. When in reality, attacks like DDoS or brute force attacks can really be simply avoided. And just as a quick explanation, what these are is when there is a server or several endpoints, wherever the attack's coming from, that sends so much data to a single server or a single endpoint or a single user all at once that it basically forces a crash. It makes the network or the system or even just the desktop crash. And within that crash and within that rebooting sequence, there are vulnerabilities that are very hard to protect against. And so it forces this reboot. It forces it into a unsafe state where it can then take advantage. And so if you just have things, there's a very simple program that we use that basically as soon as it receives a couple too many requests, it just blocks the rest. Mm-hmm. it just straight up makes it so your network won't take anymore, so it can't crash from it until it can query through. And it alerts us. We can deal with the DDoS attack as it happens. And honestly, from the user's endpoints, they never even know that it happened.
And I just had another taste of that whiskey, so I'm going off on a tangent, but I'm still recovering. I'm a little teary-eyed, actually.
No, that's fine. I might get
it. I didn't prep for it. I took a bigger sip than I thought I was going to take.
Oh, yeah. It happens.
you know. Okay, so you mentioned tools.
Sure.
I know we talked about Sentinel One.
Yes.
But there's other components here.
Yeah.
It's a whole suite. So maybe if you could go through some of the other, you know, technologies that Intuitive uses, or you could actually just get to help out with this.
Absolutely. Kind of stack. So at the end of the day, there's a lot of options. That's probably one of the most frustrating things. I say frustrating tongue in cheek because it does obviously generate us business, but it is one of the most frustrating things working in IT. Watch your head there.
Yeah.
I think you drank a little bit too much. that's probably...
Updated it out.
Yeah. That's probably one of the more frustrating things in the industry is that there are so many options to protect yourself, but it may be almost an embarrassment of wealth where there are so many options you never know what's good enough. At the end of the day, we always encourage folks, get anything. You don't need to get everything, just get something to help yourself. For most of our customers, we have obviously our Sentinel One and the suite of other antivirus that comes with it. We have email protection. We have endpoint protection. Each one's a separate program or set of programs that basically we find each area of vulnerability, whether it's email, specific endpoint, physical security, and we either arm the company or take care of it ourselves in a sense where they are protected, where it's, in a sense, it's, it's my military poking, but it's army proof, right? Even if you have someone who is actively trying to hurt stuff, it's not going to hurt your program because you have all these safeguards in effect.
Right, so it's about covering your vulnerabilities.
Exactly. It's making it so even if you have Joe Bob over in marketing who clicks on a bad email, nothing happens with it. It gets caught, it gets filtered away. Ideally, that email never even reaches Joe Bob, and you never even know that you were targeted.
That's a very specific name.
Well... Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I know any Joe Bobs, but I'm sure that if we have any clients with a Joe Bob in them and they're listening to this, they might feel a little bit attacked. So, Joe Bob, if you're out there, I apologize.
So, vulnerabilities. What kind of company or like who would be most vulnerable?
That's a great question, but unfortunately, it changes day to day who gets targeted more. Most of the time, what we've seen historically is obviously healthcare, financial and insurance agencies, universities, but for different reasons. They're all targeted for different reasons. The people who are attacking are very smart. They know exactly what they're doing, exactly what they're trying to get. For example, if someone in construction is attacked, it's usually for money. They know that there's a lot of revenue passing right through. They're trying to get the money, shut them down. If it's something like healthcare, they're trying to get information. They're trying to, if they lock you out of something, it's because sometimes they want the money. Healthcare can usually get a lot of money for these ransoms. But just like that Blue Cross incident from a few years ago, or Blue Shield, whichever it was, where 91 million people and their accounts were compromised. That was just information that was passed on to information brokers and made a lot of money just off of having the information. Obviously, financial, insurance, banks, if you can break into there's a lot of money to be had if they comply. If not, you've put a business that you may not agree with out of service for however much time until they recover. So it's very multifaceted.
Right.
Usually,
I would think there's also an extortion component. I mean, that sometimes it isn't really talked about, but I would say that's more like people who maybe have really, really, really important information.
Yeah, so we're actually working with a group right now who is a consultation and tax broker group, and we're helping them set up their cybersecurity. And they're a smaller business. They do enterprise work. They do taxes for several very large companies. However, They themselves are under 50 employees. They are, by our own definition, our own security algorithms, they are the perfect target for some of these attacks because they have access to a lot of money information. They have access to a lot of personal information. And just by and large, being a smaller company, they don't have as much revenue flow, which means that they can't traditionally afford a lot of, or they don't think they can afford a lot of what is necessary to keep them safe. So they become a target. Just even if you know nothing about them, you know that they're in danger. So it's companies like that that we really like to step in, even if we don't work with them as an MSP. We like to educate them as to their options so that not only they can stay safe, but obviously their clients and those that they work with can as well.
Right. You know, social security numbers, I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm really, really cautious about my SSN and that type of information. And I'm just thinking accountants, tax accountants in this scenario, like imagine, you know, getting ransomware and all your clients, all their information, their social security numbers encrypted.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or taken.
Yeah. I mean, every time that you have ransomware attack, there's obviously the, well, now all my stuff's locked out. I can't do my business. I can't work. Oh no, how am I going to get this back? But there is that second aspect of it that you mentioned where it's, well, now not only do I not have access to my stuff, someone else, this third party that I may never know who it is, they do. Whether it's domestic or an international threat, there's, you know, different levels of threat that come from that. And so just preparing folks for that and letting people know how prevalent it is really just, you know, it's very important to let folks know because the times are changing so quick. This wasn't an issue 10 years ago.
No.
It just wasn't.
And I'm just thinking liability. Like, I mean, getting sued because...
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, technically, I guess it'd be considered because what they're going to say is it was negligence.
It is. Part. Absolutely, especially for a lot of financial institutions. There, if the ransomware attack itself doesn't get you, the lawsuits following might. A lot of times, that's just how it works, and people know this.
Man, I'm just trying to take all this in. It's crazy. It really is. Like,
it is. Even if you have a baseline knowledge of ransomware, like I'm sure that you do, going and diving deep into the implications of it for different businesses is terrifying. Makes you want to have another drink, honestly.
I don't know if I have two or three of these foolproofs. I think it would be a much different podcast.
Man, this is good, though. I do notice I'm a little bit deeper into my glass than you are. Though, I'm kind of hungry. Last time you gave me some really good advice with that brisket. Ed's a coworker of ours, and he makes a mean barbecue. I actually ate out with him pretty soon after that. What food would you say goes good with this one?
Ooh. Steak. Steak or even like a nice pork chop would be really good with this.
Man, you keep talking my language. I love these.
I mean, it's going to be a protein. I'm not going to come at you with a vegan or vegetarian dish for whiskey. It's just not going to work.
I know that this podcast probably will have a delay to when it'll come out, so I'm going to take out my phone and start recording this myself so I can go to my wife and say, see, Adrian told me I kind of need to do it now. So that way we have proof. Let's go over this again. We need steak.
We need steak, yes, or pork chops.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah, preferably a tomahawk, though.
Oh, man.
So I've actually
sound guy approves. Yeah,
side tangent here, but I'm actually looking into how to self like dry age steaks myself. So I'm trying to pick up some like good like prime.
Okay.
And do like a dry aging.
How does that work?
You gotta have the right humidity. I think that's the key. Is what I've kind of been reading into. So I gotta find somewhere that I have access to be able to do that properly. Another thing that's supposed to be pretty cool is like you encase the steak in like butter.
Okay.
Because we all know that butter is the perfect complement to steak. Yeah.
So real quick question, and this might be stupid. I'm chuck full of those. I am nowhere near the level of knowledge when it comes to either cooking or bourbon, which is why I've been enjoying, you know, even just talking about this podcast so much. Now, I know with wine, there are a lot of good wines, but then there are a lot of cooking wines, and they don't always mix which ones are which. It's not like they're interchangeable. With bourbon, do you ever cook with bourbon?
All the time.
Okay.
I marinate with bourbon. It's a great tenderizer. You know, I put bourbon in sauces, desserts, actually a lot of baking.
Okay.
I do a pretty good, it's like a molten chocolate lava cake.
Ooh.
But for the ganache, I actually infuse it with bourbon.
Okay. And is that just the alcohol burns away like any other, or do you ever purposely make it a little boozy?
Oh, no, for that one, it's boozy.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You can't really burn off because it's chocolate.
Sure.
To be able to burn up the actual whiskey to not make it alcoholic. I'm sure there's a way to do it, but I'd probably end up just burning the chocolate.
Sure, sure. So what about this? This 1792 full proof. Have you ever cooked with it?
No, I drink that.
Fair enough. Oh, man, the more we talk, the more, I don't want to say insulted, because that puts a real negative twist and limits me for the future. The more saddened I am that I have not eaten at your house too much. Like, you're talking about all these amazing foods and desserts. Man, I need to break in or something one of these nights just to be there.
Oh, yeah, dude. You'll peruse the whiskey collection.
Well, I've seen that. I have seen your whiskey collection, which...
I think I have about 320 bottles.
Yeah, I was going to say. My guess was around the 200 mark, but there comes a certain point when, you know, that's just what it is.
Right. You know, this has been really good information. I hope that, you know, the people listening really have more, like a lot better grasp over ransomware. You know... It's really sad. You know, we come in, usually if they're not current clients, because if they're current clients, we just don't really experience the horror stories too much.
Right.
Usually when we talk about clients, it's because we're being contacted after the fact.
Right.
And that is coming more and more often. So I think that to have a PSA out there with this information is going to hopefully help out some people.
Absolutely. If nothing else, you know, just understand that it's much more prevalent than most folks understand. It, even just within our area of work around here in Rockland, Roseville, Sacramento area, for this one office, we get contacted about ransomware attacks fairly often. And not only that, a lot of the times, if the ransomware has already happened, it's kind of just damage control at that point. So we'll kind of be talking about that damage control, not only for ransomware, but for others, and kind of the steps you can take after an event, probably in a future episode. But for now, I think I kind of just want to finish this cup.
I agree. Well, hey, it's been great. I hope you guys found this information useful. And I'm hoping that, you know, if you're not currently having a glass of whiskey, that you pour yourself something. You deserve it. And, we'll definitely be in touch in the next episode. And we have some cool things planned. We kind of been talking stuff out, so please stay tuned for the notification as to when that's going to be airing, and we'll go from there.
Either way, we'll be drinking next week, and we'll see you then.